I'll call the meeting to order. We're a little bit late in starting, and I was hoping to have more members here because we're going to go through the accounting shifts that Representative Garofalo actually asked for some discussion of, and we were hoping he would get here for it, but we waited 5 minutes, and so I think we'll just go ahead and start. We don't have any minutes for today or anything to move. We're having all hearings that we will just digest and go from there. But before we get to the governor's proposals, and we do have Commissioner Segrin here, and we thank her for that, we are going to go through some education for ourselves on education funding shifts that some members like Representative Garofalo asked for some discussion of. We all know that in the year 2003, there was almost $1 billion worth of shifting coming out of education, and yet education didn't get any of those dollars. In fact, we were cut $185 million, and special ed was capped. And so those of us, as we go forward in the session, need to be aware of that. We need to know about shifts so we can protect ourselves amongst our other caucus members. So we thought, who better to tell us about this than our own fiscal staff? So I'll call on Greg Crow, and in the first green folder, members, he has a very nice memo that we might want to hang on to. Mr. Crow.
Right, Madam Chair and members, there's a sheet that says State Education Funding Accounting Shifts. It's a Money Matters publication that's available on our website. In addition, I'd have you fold out this pink sheet that has a chart that I'll kind of use to help explain one of the shifts. I'm not going to take a lot of time, and you can sure read this and call me or email if you have questions. But basically, we have two kinds of shifts, school payment shifts on the aid side, and property tax recognition shifts on the levy side. Both of those shifts generate changes in state aid and can be used as kind of a budgeting gimmick to generate savings on the state budget. Kind of big picture, the reason for this is that the state and school districts use different accounting methods. School districts use accrual accounting, which requires them to to count revenue that they're expected to receive as revenue for the current year, regardless of when it gets paid to them. The state, on the other hand, uses cash accounting, which basically counts liabilities and revenues at the time that they're actually collected. So because of that, if the state can change the fiscal year in which it's making a payment to the school district, it saves the state money because of using cash accounting, but it doesn't affect the school district's budget because they still count that money as revenue for the fiscal year in which they're entitled to receive it. So that's kind of one little bit of jargon, accounting jargon for you, the cash and accrual accounting. Another kind of jargon I'm going to throw out as we're talking about this is entitlements versus appropriations, and we've talked about this before as well. When we calculate a formula, it's $100 per student. We multiply $100 times the number of students, and that generates the total cost that that formula creates, and we call that the entitlement. Basically, the school districts are entitled to receive that $100 per kid, that total dollar amount, during that school year. Now, because we don't, and then the second term is the appropriation, and that's how much the state appropriates to pay for that, and that's not the same as the entitlement. The appropriation is different because we always pay districts only a portion of their money, of their entitlement, in the year in which it's due, and then we make a makeup payment or a final payment in the next fiscal year to help account for things like pupil count changes, things that might change, so we make sure that we get the final data before we make that final payment. So when we do an appropriation, what we do is we pay 90% under current law. That's the portion we pay for the current year, and then the makeup payment is 10% of the entitlement. So if an entitlement, for example, is $1 billion for a program, we pay $900 million in the current year, and then the next year we budget $100 million for the makeup payment for that entitlement. Now the schools, when they look at that $1 billion, they count that whole $1 billion as revenue for the current fiscal year, and that goes back to that cash versus accrual accounting. And now that $100 million that goes into the final payment usually isn't the $100 million, because when we get to that point, we have final data about pupil counts, and it might be a little more than $100 million or a little less. Just depends on what it takes to kind of balance out what happened with the estimated cost from the previous year. So, how does that let us save money on the state side? Well, if we change that payment percentage from 90-10 to say 80-20, the state basically, the school districts still see that 100% of their entitlement as their revenue. So they're still getting the same amount of revenue. But the state only has to, for that 1 year, pay 80% instead of 90% of the current entitlement. And so the state can take that 10% that we haven't paid and book that as general fund savings in the state budget. And if you look on page 2 of the handout, there's a chart that kind of shows what happens when the state, from the funding perspective, when the state goes from 90-10 to 80-20. So you can pick, there's two groups of rows, of 5 rows each, and then there's a third group called difference. So in the first group, we're paying 90-10 the whole time. The entitlement is $1 million. So take fiscal 2008, for example. There's $1 million entitlement. We're paying 100% from the previous year's $1 million that we still owe the school districts. Then we're paying $900,000 from the current year. We end up paying out $1 million, but it's not the $1 million of the entitlements. It's $900 from this year and $100 from the year before. But the schools are still getting, and the schools are seeing $1 million of revenue, which is the total of the entitlement. Now the next group is what happens if that changes from 90-10 to 80-20. So you can see in fiscal 2009, the current and final changes from 90%, 10%, to 80%, 20%. The entitlement is still $1 million. The final payment from the previous year is still $100,000, but we only have to pay $800,000 on the current year because we're down to 80%. So the total state payment is $900,000. The revenue to the schools is $1 million. Then if you look in fiscal 2011, if we go back to 90-10 from 80-20, you can see the final payment from the previous year is $200,000 because it's now 20% of the entitlement. But we've also got to pay $900,000 for the current year. So the state pays out $1.1 million, and the revenue to the schools still stays at $1 million. And then the difference, you can see, is what the change is. It's $100,000. So basically, the state saves $100,000 in the year it makes that change, and then has to pay back, in a sense, $100,000 to the schools, or make advance payments in the current fiscal year to reduce that to 90-10. And the pink sheet is a graphical example of that, and it kind of makes it a little easier to understand. The first group of columns on the left, where it says 90-10 all years on the top, shows what the state is paying on the 100% entitlement. So each year, the current payment is 90%, the previous year's final payment is 10%. The little arrows connect the entitlement. So each arrow connects a total that's 100%. So each entitlement is always 100%. So you can see in this example, the $1 million entitlement costs $1 million every year to the state because we're paying 90, 90, and 10, and there's no change. Now in the next one, in the next group of columns, in fiscal 2009, it's changed from 90-10 to 80-20. So you can see the first arrow connects the 90 and 10. For the 100% entitlement for fiscal 2008, and then in fiscal 2009 we still have 100% entitlement, but only 80% of it is paid in 2009. Then we're picking up the 10% from the previous year. So the total of all the state payments is 90% of that entitlement, and the gap between the $1 million line and the 10% is the $100,000 of savings. So that little chunk of space there is the state savings when an aid payment shift is created. Okay? So then in the next year, we're still at 80-20, and you can see that the in fiscal 10, the total state payments goes back because we've picked up the 20% from the previous year on the final payment and 80% from the current year. Then in 2011, if we shifted back from 80-20 to 90-10, you can see you're still picking up the 20% from the previous year's entitlement, the current payment, but the current payment is 90%. So now we're above the line by the exact same amount we were below the line in 2009. And that's as if we were paying back that shift. So that's where you see the cost of paying back a shift is having to pick up that extra 10% of those payments during that year when you make the shift. So the other thing to note is that it's a zero-sum kind of game. In other words, the distance below the line is the same as the distance above the line. In other words, money isn't created or lost as you shift and unshift. Sometimes when we look at what we've shifted and how much we've saved and then what we have to quote-unquote pay back to restore the shift amount, it looks like we're paying back more. Well, the reason for that is if the entitlement goes up, you actually every year generate a little bit of shift savings every year. Even though kind of when we talk about shifting, we talk about it as one-time cost, you actually over time, as the entitlement grows, generating a little bit more of shift savings to the state's bottom line every year, the state saving a little bit of money. And I put another chart in on page 3 that shows what happens when there's a growing entitlement. So in this case, the entitlement starts at $800,000 and grows by $100,000 each year. So in that second group, you can see if you have a $1 million entitlement and you shift to an 80-20, your final payment from the previous year is $90,000 and your current payment for the current year is $800,000. So you're paying out $890,000 in fiscal 09 on a million dollar entitlement. And if you can see above in FY 09 under 90-10, we're paying $990,000. So that saves us $100,000, and that's the negative $100,000 you see in the difference. Well, in the next year, as the entitlement goes up $100,000. If you look in the fiscal 10 row, under 90-10, you'd be paying $100,990, while under 80-20, you're paying $200,000 and $880,000. So you're actually shifting another $10,000, which is, you know, the easy math is the entitlement went up $100, you shifted 10%, you're shifting $10,000 again that year. So the amount that you shifted, if it's you save that percentage of the growth in the entitlement each year. So if the entitlement grows $1 million and you've shifted another 5% originally, you actually save another $5,000 that year. So then when you go to pay it back, you can see in the bottom row when you go back to 90-10, you end up paying $1.3 million on total state payments, which is $110,000 more than the $1,190,000 you'd pay under 90-10. So you might look at that and you say, well, okay, we saved $100,000 when we instituted the shift in one-time money, but it cost $110,000 to restore the shift back to 90-10. But really, you saved $110,000, and there was that interim year where the state would save an extra $10,000. So as the entitlement grows, you're generating more money each year. Another way to think about it is the state kind of borrows from school districts when we do this in a sense. If you go from 90-10 to 80-20 and it's this amount of entitlement, we're basically saying, okay, school districts, you're going to let us keep $100,000 or borrow $100,000 that we owe you, and we'll pay you back next year. And we'll catch you after the next fiscal year starts. And that saves the state that money in the current fiscal year. Well, then you get to the next fiscal year, and we're really not carrying the full amount forward. The next fiscal year, that next fall, as we're making payments, we pay the districts the whole amount they're owed. But then what happens is you get to the end of that fiscal year, and you say, okay, we're going to borrow another $100,000, another 10%. And so if the entitlement is flat every year, we're saying, okay, we're keeping $100,000, now we're paying it to you. We're keeping it at the end of the fiscal year. At the beginning, we're going to pay it back to you. Well, if the entitlement grows, we're really saying we're keeping 10%. So we're going to keep 10%, that's $100,000. We're going to give you $100,000 at the beginning of the next fiscal year. Then you get to the end of the second fiscal year, you say, we're going to keep 10%. Well, the entitlement's grown. So, well, it's $110,000 this time. And then next year, we're going to pay you back $110,000. And as long as you don't change that shift percentage, you don't really see the fact that we're kind of, that the obligation or the cost is growing over time. You just see it when you get to the point where you actually are changing it back. And so, but what's really happening is that every year we're moving a larger and larger amount, and then paying back the school district. So that's kind of the basics of the age shift. The property tax shift description starts on page 4. And the property tax shift is, we call it a recognition shift, because what it is when we tell districts when they have to recognize revenue for their budget purposes. So, as I'm sure you know, property tax payments are made in May and October for the most part. And those two payments, for school purposes, when you make your property tax payments, the county transfers the money to the school district, usually the next month after those payments are made. And those payments for the schools are revenue for the fiscal year and the school year that starts on July 1st. So, in other words, property taxes that are paid, for example, this calendar year in May of 2008 and in October of 2008, are revenue for the schools starting July 1st of 2008, which is the 08-09 school year or fiscal year. When we do a recognition shift, what we tell them is you have to recognize some of the revenue that you're going to collect in May of 2008 you have to recognize that as money to spend for the current school year that's just about to end, 2007-2008. And so when we do that, districts look at, a school district has $1 million of property tax revenue, and we institute a shift against $2 million of total revenue. So they get $1 million from the state and $1 million from their property taxes. If we do a 25% shift, basically we're saying take half of your May revenue, because it's split in half between May and October. So take half of your May revenue and apply that to the current school year. So that would be on $1 million. That's half of the. They collect $500,000 in May, $500,000 in October. They get $250,000 that they'd have to count as revenue for their current school year. Now we don't say, okay, you've got $1 million that you collected last year in property taxes. The state gave you $1 million. Now we're recognizing $250,000. You don't get to have extra money for that current school year. What the state says is, hey, you just generated $250,000 of extra levy that's a bonus to you, so we're going to take away $250,000 of your state aid, and we'll catch you next year. And so what that does is then the state's obligation goes down by that $250,000 that the district is basically filling in with early recognition of its property tax revenue. And so if the state tells the school district you have to collect it and account for it this way, then they count it that way, the state sees a savings. Then the next year, they're short $250,000 because they recognized it early. So then, the normal practice then is the shift is kind of ongoing, and we say, well, get $250,000 from the next year and count that this year, and that'll cover the hole that's created there. And that goes on until the state says, well, quit shifting. And then when the state says quit shifting, then they have a hole. So then the state has to come in and say, okay, now you're short, and we're going to pay state aid to fill in that hole so they to keep your entitlement, your revenue at where your entitlement is. So that's when we pay back a property tax shift, is when we eliminate that recognition shift. And so that's when it costs the state budget money to create or to undo a recognition shift. That's why it costs the state budget money. All right, so then the very back page, two things that you might want to see under the implications in the current environment. Basically, there's a rule of thumb in there that says for each percent of school payment shift, we get $68.5 million in aid savings to the state budget. So in that 90-10 example, if we go from 90-10 to 80-20, the state would see a $685 million one-time reduction in its current budget general fund obligation. On the property tax side, each percentage of a property tax shift, because it's against a lower number, generates $5 million, $5.3 million of aid savings. And to give you a little context, I put a table with the changes that were made in 2002, 2003. We went from 90-10 in 02 to 83-17, and then as there was continued pressure on the budget, the 03 bill increased the shift amount to 80-20. That going from 90-10 to 80-20 at that time saved the $438 plus $184 million. So almost over $600 million in savings just on the aid payment side. And then the property tax shift was increased from up to 48.6%, which saved the state about $250 million. And then there was a provision put into statute that said as if there were surpluses in forecast, those payment shifts after budget reserves were reached a certain level would start being reduced. And so you can see we had some pretty wacky percentages because we started at 80-20 and then there was some money available, so it went to 81.9, 18.1, and then progressed through until the November 2005 forecast where it was restored all the way back to 90-10. And then there was enough money to lower the property tax shift to 10.8 in November of 05, and then February of 06, the property tax shift was eliminated because of the surplus funds that were available. One thing relevant to your discussion today, at the time that those shifts were instituted, we put a provision into law that said districts in statutory operating debt could get up to 7% more. So at 80-20, they could get 87-13 so that their cash flow wasn't as impacted. And I didn't really cover that, but while we say to districts that, you know, districts say they're going to receive the same amount of revenue, because they receive the money over time, their cash flow doesn't always fit. If we slow the payments down like this, it doesn't, and so they have to use, we say this is a no-cost item for school districts, but technically you could argue that they're either losing interest revenue on a fund balance because they have to use their fund balance to cover their cash flow, or they have to do short-term borrowing, so they have interest costs to do short-term borrowing for cash flow purposes, which we allow them to do. But because districts and SOD, it would affect them because they don't have fund balances, there's a provision put in saying we could accelerate their payments a little more. And in the governor's budget proposal that you hear, the governor is proposing getting rid of that because right now we're paying some districts in SOD at 97.3 because we didn't adjust that when we went back to 90-10. We left it at they can get 7% more. So some districts are getting 97% of their entitlement in the current year instead of 90%. And we'll let the department talk a little bit more about that. But it's connected to that. So I think that's it. That's their question.
Thank you very much, Mr. Crow. And now we can see why when government decides to shift school funding, the public does not understand quite what happens. But I will just say it is not a good thing for schools. You know, eventually the state has to pay it back, and it costs more. And while it's in operation, schools have to do short-term borrowing and pay it back. That's what we really need to know. And for those of us, which I suspect is most all of us up here at this table, if not all of us, interested in doing the long-term education finance reform, if we first have to pay schools back, because we did a lot of shifting this year, then that sets us back on being able to do that. Representative Faust, Representative Heidgerken, and then we are going to go to the governor's bill. Mr. Segrin is here, and I don't want to take too much more time on this. And if there are questions on shifting, there is one very small shift in the governor's bill where people can continue to ask questions. Representative Faust.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question for Greg Crowe is on the back sheet of the thing you just went through. I noticed that in 2003 there's a recognition shift that gains the state $253,000, and yet in the 2 years in 2005 and 2006 when they paid that back, it was $420 million. $253 million. When they paid it back, it was $420 million. Is that typically how it works, that it's that much larger when they pay it back? So that, that's almost double.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Representative Faulkner, and I don't know if I specifically said it on recognition shifts, but the same thing that happens as entitlement grows on the aid shift happens on the recognition shift if total levies are growing. So in other words, if you start at $1 billion worth of levies and you're shifting 10% of them, the state saves $100 million. And then at the end, if you have $2 billion of shifts, the $2 billion of levies, and the shift is 10%, you have the $200 million, and that's what it costs you to pay it back. But over time, what this doesn't show is that over time, those shifts each year were generating generating aid savings to the state as levies were growing. So what happened here is levies were growing pretty rapidly between 2003 and 2006 statewide, and so the amount shifted each year. So between 2003 and 2006, there was an additional, we had a total of 425 versus 253 that we gained. So there was a total of $175 million of additional shift savings that happened each year, or spread over that 3 year period versus what's shown on the chart as those kind of initial one time savings. And so it's typical of growing levies and the rate that they're growing that ended up that way.
Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think, Madam Chair, you and I and Representative Olson and Representative Erickson were on the committee when the state was in the tank at $4.6 million. We did some transition money, but the complaints of all the school districts back then was the shifts that were going in, that Mr. Crowe, you addressed it very well. The state, did what they had to do, but yet at the same time it sent many a school district of borrowing. And that was addressed very well by you. But anyways, let's hope we don't do any more shifts.
Thank you, Representative Heidgerken. I agree. All right. Now before I give the gavel to Representative Morrill, because I am the author of the governor's bill, so I'll join Representative Segrin down there at the table. We are now having passed out a spreadsheet on the governor's bill that Mr. Crowe is going to go through briefly, and while we make the transition, so maybe we could get down to the table and Representative Morrill could get over here, and Mr. Crowe, when you all get your sheets, can go through it. I'm sitting at Representative Segrin's left, of course.
Yes. Mr. Crowe, do you want to start going through the spreadsheet?
Mr. Chair and members, we have a one-page spreadsheet that you should be familiar, or should look familiar. It's kind of laid out exactly how our normal tracking sheet is for the omnibus budget bill. And so it's just a bit shorter because it only includes the changes that were proposed in the governor's budget. So as is typical, we show the program on the left, and then there are six columns of February forecast data for each year of this biennium and the next biennium. Obviously, they're mostly zeros because these are mostly new initiatives by the governor. And then there are eight columns on the right that show the governor's recommendations and the change from base. And you'll hear about each one specifically as Commissioner Segrin goes through the bill. You can see the total on line 42 is a difference from base of negative $2.392 million in the current biennium and positive $11.5 million of spending in the next biennium. There is, as I mentioned, a $6 million shift on line 4 in the governor's budget. If you back that out, which line 46 and 7 does, line 49 shows you how much new spending there is, excluding the shift amount. And you can see it's $5.24 million in the current biennium and $11,499 the far lower right cell should read. Have an error in that cell, but that $11,499 in the governor's budget is new spending in fiscal 10 and 11.
Great, thank you. And Representative Bradley, would you like to move the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move your House file.
3951?
House file 3951, I would move, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Bradley. I understand also there's an author's amendment.
Oh, yes, there is. I would move the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Does everyone have a copy of the A1 amendment?
Yes.
As everyone's looking for it, Commissioner, you have it as well?
Yes, I
do. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? Thank you. Commissioner, or Representative Bradley, what does the A1 amendment do?
Mr. Chair and members, what the A1 amendment does is take some monies that were unexpended for flood relief from last year and allowing that money to be used for Rushford Peterson, I think, to address some of their declining enrollment, and I think there's one other issue, but that's the kind of the intent of the amendment.
Thank you. Any questions or discussions to the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the motion on the amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. We'll turn to the bill itself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm going to go through a quick PowerPoint with you. There's one section of the bill that is not covered in the PowerPoint, and if you look at the governor's bill, it's section 1. And that is in regard to teacher quality. It wasn't listed in our PowerPoint, but I wanted to draw your attention to it. The governor has proposed having a regular review of teachers that have already attained tenure so that we can look at the ability for teachers to be observed and evaluated each year as they're teaching. And the intent is to provide the continuous improvement, setting professional goals, looking at data around their students, and doing professional development and evaluation. As you may know or may not know, teachers, once they're tenured, are not required to have any kind of evaluation, except that many districts have an evaluation maybe once every 3 to 5 years. So you can have a teacher that teaches 30 years but only has had any kind of an evaluation of their performance 10 times in a 30-year career. So the governor is proposing that teachers, once they're tenured, continue to have annual ongoing evaluations or regular evaluations that would provide the feedback and the support that they would need to continually improve as a professional. So that is just the part of the section. And now we'll go to the PowerPoint. the governor is talking a lot about quality teachers and how we can support them in the classroom. And the research behind that is emphasized in this PowerPoint, this first slide. Dr. Morgano has found that effective teachers have a 43% positive impact on student achievement, the highest school-based factor. By comparison, class size only has an 8% positive impact. If you look at data from Tennessee, studies have shown that if you have two average 8-year-olds and were given different teachers, one of them a high-performing teacher and the other a low-performing, the student's performance diverged more than 50 percentile points within 3 years. Dallas study found that the performance gap between students assigned to three effective teachers in a row and those assigned to less effective teachers in a row, there was a 49% differential in their achievement. Because of that, we are looking at teacher quality and how we can support teachers in the classroom. We know that within the next 10 to 15 years, if you look at this graph, you will see that we're going to have almost 50% of our teachers leaving the profession due to retirement age. So we're looking at three strategies to increase the supply of highly effective teachers. We want to retain, we want to retrain the existing teaching workforce because we are demanding of them new academic standards, and we want to come alongside of them to support them in a consistent way. We also want to think about how we can recruit and retain, recruit the best and the brightest into the teaching profession, and then look at strategies to retain them. One of the things that we have certainly done, and we appreciate the support from last year, was to create math and science academies for teachers. The governor, in addition to that, would like to create math and science institutes, which would be an even more robust opportunity for teachers. It would be actually a two-week summer experience, very intensive, that would be run by our higher ed institutions that have professors and content specialty. And then they would have a five-day opportunity within the school year after they complete the two-week program. Then they would also be continuing work with the higher ed institutions with how they're implementing what they've learned in the two-week institute. The total request, we are asking for $1.2 million for the institute each year and then another $1.5 for a math and science academy. We had requested $3 million each year of the biennium for a math and science academy. We received only half of that. So the total amount that we would like to receive each year and ongoing would be $2.7 million to do both of those. We also are looking at how we could attract more highly qualified people into the teaching profession. And so we're looking at two strategies, alternative strategies. We would like to partner with higher ed institutions and select applicants in the teacher license shortage areas of math, science, special ed, world languages, and ELL. And we would like to look at two. We would like to look at those who are potentially are starting their career, they've received a bachelor's degree in one of these content areas, they weren't necessarily thinking about going into teaching, they're seeing if we can't attract them into the teaching profession but by providing them with an intensive experience of pedagogy and then bringing them into the profession. We also would like to look at mid-career changers with the same kind of a process. To look at how they could come into the profession with a very intensive pedagogical experience in the summer, go in with a mentor, and they would have to be selected through a very rigorous selection process. It wouldn't just be anybody that would like to do that, but there would be a highly selected selection process to go through this. And then they would be able to, once the candidates were hired, and you would have to also have the guarantee that you would be someone that would have a job once they were selected, they could earn up to 15 graduate credits. The request for this would be $250,000 to get this started in 2009, and then ongoing $1.75 million that would actually support the higher ed institution in the process of doing this. As I said, here would be the requirements. In higher ed, you would have to have a bachelor's degree from a four-year accredited post-secondary institution and a 3.0 GPA on a four-point scale. You would have to pass two competency tests before you could be considered You would have to show employment experience if you were a mid-career changer or experience related to the subjects that you're going to teach. You would have to go through an interview process that an interview committee made up of. We would certainly would want teachers to be engaged in this interview process. We would have a final selection where districts would select candidates after the candidate meets all the requirements, and then you'd have a license that would be restricted to math, science, special ed, and world languages and ELL. The Minnesota TEACH model is modeled after the Teaching Fellows Program in New York City. In 2000, the New York City Department of Education created its first cohort of Teaching Fellows. In 2003, the New York State Regents eliminated temporary licenses, and they had a huge problem in New York. We don't have that situation, but they had a huge problem with unlicensed or temporary licensed teachers. When they instituted their program, the average score on the New York Teacher Certification Exam went, you had the Teach for America participants, their score was 276. Teaching Fellow participants were 267. The College of Education Traditional Route graduates was 246, and teachers hired on temporary license, which is no surprise, was 242. So you can see that if we're concerned about the quality of teacher that would be attracted to these programs, when New York implemented their process, they actually had very high-scoring candidates. The Brookings Institute was talking about that they have a Hamilton project, and they, the quote there is, the authors recommended that removing barriers to teaching will encourage new college graduates and mid-career professionals into the profession. The authors also recommended tracking teacher and student performance and making teacher tenure more difficult. The authors also studied teacher effectiveness in LA Unified School District and found that screening out the least effective teachers would have raised student test scores 14 percentile points by graduation. And Bill Gates also said America will find it infinitely more difficult to maintain its technological leadership if it shuts out the very people who are able to help us compete. We are driving away the world's best and brightest precisely when we need them the most. The McKinsey report also looked at top-performing countries and what is going on in the United States, in top-performing states and school districts and in other countries. Number one, they get the right people to become teachers. The quality of an educational system cannot exceed the quality of its teachers. They develop these people into effective instructors. The only way to improve outcomes is to improve instruction. And they put in place systems and targeted support to ensure that every child is able to benefit from excellent instruction. And the only way for the system to reach the highest performance is to raise the standards for every student. The UTEACH program is modeled after a program in Texas. And we are very excited about this concept also. We would recruit current students that are in college, haven't declared a major yet, but would give them an opportunity to take 6 education courses at no cost to the students. And so that would be what the money would be for. The Texas UTEACH program started in 1997 at the University of Texas, Austin. The current students in the program are 480. The students have a higher GPA and ACT SAT scores to qualify to be in the UTEACH program. And once UTEACH students enter the profession, about 3/4 remain after 5 years. This compares to about 50% retention in Minnesota for teachers after the first 5 years. And the program was singled out as a success by Math and Science Institute in the report Rising Above the Gathering Storm. So we would propose providing college students who are right now in college that are interested in our shortage areas and give them the opportunity to take some college courses, teaching courses, and see if we can't entice them into the teaching profession. The UTEACH program has really been very highly successful, and we would like to try that out here in Minnesota. Of course, we have TUCOMP. That's an ongoing program that is also coming alongside of our teachers to professionally develop them, provide career ladders, to look at evaluation that's ongoing for them, observation, and provide the kind of compensation when they are excellent, when they prove their excellence in the classroom. We also are very interested in building the capacity in our principal leadership area. We know that most of the BPI schools that we see all the time have had a principal at its helm that has really been able to bring together their team of teachers in ways that are exciting and provide for the change that is needed. We are very excited about this program. It has begun. It began in 2006. We have trainers that are ready to go, and we have a cohort or two that have already been through the program. However, last year our funding inadvertently got deleted from our finance bill. So we are back to ask for the support for this. It would be $400,000 each year ongoing. The $400,000 each year will be able to train approximately 100 principals every year. So we'd have 200 going through each biennium. And I have with me Fred Stardy, who is the executive director of the Elementary Principals Association, and he would just like to give a little comment about the Principals Institute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome, Mr. Stardy. If you just would state your name, position, and go off for your testimony.
Yes, Fred Stardy, executive director of the Minnesota Elementary School Principals Association. Thank you so much. We're just thrilled to have in the governor's budget, the supplemental budget, the Principals Academy. It's been great to hear about many of the professional development programs that we're considering for teachers, and now we're thrilled to have something here for our principals. As the commissioner said, in 2005 the program was funded. We got it started in 2006 and in 2007, and we'd like to get it refunded again to keep the momentum going in training our principals. I would just like to say that the program that we use, the National Institute for School Leaders, is an excellent curriculum. And what makes this program stand aside from other leadership programs is it focuses on instructional leadership. Two of the units in the program focus on literacy leadership and numeracy leadership, reading and math. And we feel that principals should be instructional leaders. That's why this program is very important to us. And you all know, if there's a good school, show me a good school, we'll show you a good principal behind that school. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Stegman.
The next proposal that the governor would like us to consider is Minnesota Virtual Education Program, and we also have some testifiers here. This is a request for the development of an online teaching and student tool. To provide teaching tools for teachers and also course opportunities for students would be maintained by the Department of Education and used by both teachers and public school students statewide. The online program will provide resources for teachers. There could be curriculum or lesson plans. There could be training for teachers on this online program. Also, we could have students with the ability to take courses or to get tutoring. The potential is unlimited. We can have ACT or SAT tutoring opportunities. Oftentimes, there are many students who don't have that opportunity, like some families, to even help their students participate in preparing for the ACT or the SAT. So the ideas are really limitless as far as what we can do with this virtual online teacher and student academy, if you will. We would have teachers developing both the coursework for students and the coursework and the curriculum and lesson plans and professional development opportunities by teachers in Minnesota. And we would request $1 million to begin the development of this online process. And we have a testifier here that would be glad to tell you about his support.
Welcome to the committee, and if you'd introduce yourself, state your name for the record, and begin.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Mark Klein. Until a few weeks ago, I was a senior member of the local Microsoft team. I recently joined a consulting firm by the name of Exceller Corporation as Vice President of Consulting. I also serve as the chair for the Minnesota High Tech Association K-12 Committee. The High Tech Association is a nonprofit trade association with a mission to support the growth, sustainability, and global competitiveness of Microsoft technology-based economy through advocacy, education, and collaboration. The association currently has about 350 members, some of the largest names in the state, and we are pleased to support the governor's education appropriations. And I'd like to make a couple of comments about House File 3951. Relative to the Minnesota Teach Program, Section 2, we're strong supporters of alternative teacher licensing. Today's careers are no longer progressed in a linear way, and in fact, the Department of Labor says that learners on average hold 14 different jobs by the time they're 40 years of age. Today's professionals are mobile and more often open to different career choices, aligning themselves to life plan stages, and our teacher licensure system needs to reflect and take advantage of these people in the workforce. We believe the proposal is a good step in the right direction in encouraging mid-career professionals in science and technology to enter teaching professionals with greater ease. It will provide capable people with the opportunity to bring their skills, experiences, and commitment to lifelong learning to the students in a more expedited manner. We acknowledge that career as an engineer or research scientist doesn't make you necessarily a good teacher. And that, in that regard, we do support and believe it must include rigorous one-year teacher training as part of the program. We also think it's a great opportunity to engage businesses actively in working the front line with teachers to help incubate the people for this program, the candidates for this program. Relative to the Youth Teach Program, Section 3, the members of the High Tech Association are also very supportive of this part of the bill as well. For math and science teachers, good students can become great with the help of teachers who excel in their area of expertise. It makes perfect sense to bolster training in math and science and technology, where the world is constantly changing, and the proposed bill does this in a very tangible and real-world way. Math and Science Teacher Academies will give teachers specialized knowledge and enhanced skills that will improve student performance. Our goal should be for teachers to truly be masters in what they're doing and keep them current, capable, and passionate about their role in such endeavors. And then lastly, relative to the Minnesota Virtual Education Program, Section 1. We're also very excited about this section as well. In the government's state address, he described it as a world-class, digitally stored, always available, anywhere, anytime, jaw-dropping, eye-popping teaching toolbox. What a mouthful. What a great tool for teachers to access top-shelf materials. And in fact, the Minnesota High Tech Association is developing our own eye-popping, jaw-dropping portal by the name of GetSTEM in coordination with the Department of Education. GetSTEM will allow us to link businesses and schools together at a local level, create community between local businesses and teachers, support a just ask and just offer relationship that can be made where teachers can just ask for support from local businesses and know who those businesses are, for businesses to just offer materials and facilities and internships to the school districts they're most interested in supporting. And it'll also package STEM best practices for reuse by other businesses and teachers. So we're very excited about that opportunity. We'll be going online with that in a testing mode shortly. So why is this all important to Minnesota high-tech industries? Because today's students will be tomorrow's scientists, engineers, network administrators, and entrepreneurs. You should be aware that high school or high-tech jobs such as these pay 67% more than the average private sector job in Minnesota. We also have 127,000 high-tech jobs in the state, and it's a growing problem for us to backfill these jobs.
Mr. Klein, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I've been called to another committee to present a bill, so I'm just going to allow Representative Erickson to assume the chair.
Please.
Please continue, sir.
Thank you. We also believe that these initiatives are important because we believe that a solid understanding of STEM is vital for today and tomorrow's complex issues. There's a direct correlation between math skills, problem-solving ability, college entrance, and college graduation rate. We don't expect everyone to become a mathematician, but we should expect everyone to know that it's better to have a 3% unemployment rate than a 6% unemployment rate, and that Minnesota continues to be the best place for great opportunities and high-paying jobs. Thank you for your time and openness to hear the Minnesota High Tech Association's position on the bill, and I'll take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. Commissioner Seegren, do you want to continue, and then we'll take questions later? Madam Chair, I don't know where that's coming from, but I think that there's someone who has a BlackBerry, perhaps that's activated, who needs to take care of that, please.
There we go.
Very good.
All right.
Mr. Seegren.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I also want to thank Mark for coming up here, too. He talked a little bit about the clearinghouse that we are creating, and Minnesota High Tech Association has been an extraordinary supporter. All of the businesses that are members of the Minnesota High Tech Association have just really stepped up to the plate. You know, we talk a lot about businesses telling us what we should do, etc., but I'm telling you that the Minnesota High Tech Association has put money where their mouth is, and they have really supported our initiative, not only in words, but in deed. The web portal that we are creating actually is going to Microsoft and Thomson West and the Minnesota High Tech Association. I have created this web portal for teachers and businesses so that teachers can ask for support from their businesses, from could you help us start a science club, do we need some interns, do we need some apprentices. We would like to, as teachers, go visit our work in your business to get an understanding of what's going on, to you know, the businesses stepping up and listing what they are willing to do, and it's going to be regional so that you can do this regionally, and it's going to be kept in perpetuity by Thomson West so that they will always keep this up to date, and it will be an asset for all teachers in the state of Minnesota. That's an incredible gift, and I don't think that the Minnesota High Tech Association, Microsoft, Thomson West, etc., have really received enough praise about this. We're going to try to brag a lot more about it when we get this out officially. But it's an example of, and if we do this Minnesota Virtual Academy, if you will, I guarantee you that we'll have the support of Minnesota High Tech Association and these companies as we go forward to help develop and get the expertise from them also to even set up this kind of a process. So I just had to thank you again for the support that you have been giving us. We want to move on. There are just some smaller budget items that we want to mention. The amendment that we voted on is related to the declining people aid and offset for Rutherford Peterson. We are going to continue to support Rutherford Peterson and their issues due to the flood. We have utility transition aid, and the Department of Revenue adopted rule changes relating to utility property that will result in lower property values. And this aid will provide relief not only to local governments but to our school districts because of this rule change. And then also, I think you had before either policy or finance the other day, the reciprocity agreement that we're working out with South Dakota. It's a very small amount of money that will be, you know, appropriated in future years. We also have within our budget a 4% reduction in our operating budget for the Department of Education. And then also there is the state operating debt aid payment shift that I think Mr. Crow mentioned. And if you would like Mr. Melcher or Dr. Melcher to come up and explain that, we would be glad to have him do that for clarification since he's a finance committee. Dr. Melcher.
Dr. Melcher, welcome to the committee. Say your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Tom Melcher. I'm the Finance Director at the Department of Education. The reverse SOD aid payment shift is related to the state aid payment shift that Mr. Crow explained earlier. Traditionally, we have funded school districts with 90% of the money for all school districts going out during the current year with a 10% final payment. We hold back the 10%, at least in part, in order to ensure that we don't overpay school districts until we have all of the final data in for the school year. At the time that we went to the 80-20 payment shift a number of years ago, there was a concern that the districts in statutory operating debt had more difficult cash flow problems than other districts because of their lack of a fund balance. And so in order to reduce the effect of the aid payment shift on the SOD districts, a provision was added to the law which said that those districts would be able to receive an additional 7%, and that moved them up to an 87% payment during the current year with a 13% final payment. We think it was an oversight to not have changed back to 90% for all school districts at the time that we went back to a 90-10 funding basis. Apparently what we're doing for all school districts except districts in SOD, we're paying 90-10, which is the historical level that we have always paid for all school districts. But the SOD districts are receiving a 97% current payment with a 3% final payment. And that puts us at risk of overpaying those school districts if there's anything more than a 3% error in terms of the estimated data that we're using for the payments during the current year.
Thank you, Mr. Melcher. Are there some questions? Representative Heidgerken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point, I, for one, feel that if we make that shift, if we go back, right now, the school districts that need the money the most are those in SOD. And I feel by doing the shift that we're going to be sending them back to the bank to borrow more money. And I, for one, when I look at the governor's proposal here, I always have a hard time of coming up with new programs when there aren't any new monies. And I'd much rather see some of the monies that the math and science, among other things, I'd much rather have the property tax relief for those school districts in SOD. I know Representative Hillstrom has a bill addressing the issue. What I worry about is her bill puts it back onto the individual school districts where they can levy up to $200,000. So we're just basically transferring a little property tax, making the school districts that suffered the most in the 01 tax reform bill pay a little bit more. When I look at the two bills, if they both happen, if this happens and Representative Hillstrom's bill happens, it's going to be even more difficult on the property tax owners. I have a handout in my office that I'll hand out. I think Representative Granny, we're going to have more discussion than this. I'll have a handout on what exactly each school district is paying on a percentage basis to better bring out my numbers. But I have an issue with those shifts.
Representative Anfield.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dovetailing off Representative Heidgerken's comments, I just find it odd, members, that we listen to a promotional and marketing speech on behalf of Microsoft and Thomson West, and then 2 minutes later we have to listen to what's going to happen to the 15 poorest districts in the state. It's just the dots. I can't connect that. The priorities are misguided here, and I hope we give this all some very serious thought. This is sending us in the wrong direction.
Representative Swales, did you have a question for Dr. Melcher? Not for Dr. Melcher, so you'll wait. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, to Representative Ansel's point, Mr. Strom, Mr. Crow, the districts that are in statutory operating debt, are they the poorest property wealth school districts in the state? That's what I heard him say. Is that true?
Mr. Crow.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, we'll print out a list for you. Several of the districts on that list are very low property wealth districts. It'll depend a little bit on the year. Hopkins, for example, was in statutory operating debt last year, and that would significantly alter the average, but I think in general they're lower than average tax-based districts.
And
not
a follow-up, just a comment, Madam Chair, and to again dovetail Representative Heigerton's comments. Not that, you know, we've already got the inner caucus Republican terrorism alert at red right now, so we don't need to pile on anymore. But I also, as well, have a concern about the shift. Remember last year there was amendments in this committee to actually go above 90. It seems like we're going the wrong way. And if we're going to be using the shifts that have to take place, it would seem to me that you probably want to save those for next year, folks. I think they're tails on 10 and 11. if you're going to use shifts, that next biennium would be the next one. But I would think that within the context of a $35 billion general fund budget, we can probably find $6 million elsewhere without unshifting the SOD school districts. Thanks.
Commissioner Stevens? Oh, I'm sure. Is there another question? Commissioner Stevens, did you have anything more to add to your presentation?
No, Madam Chair, not at all. If I appear to be doing a commercial, I would like to tell you that we often don't thank our partners for what they are doing, and this is all done free. And I think we also need to thank people once in a while for the good work that they do in supporting our schools.
Representative Greitling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't really have anything to add other than that Representative Mariani, who's the author of the policy bill for the governor's office, is ill. So, you know, I can hold down the fort for him if you want to proceed to that bill. And I'm going to recommend that because the policy committee went over that this bill very carefully, that perhaps the commissioner could just focus on the finance provisions. And, of course, if members have questions on the policy, they could ask those, but maybe the initial presentation could just cover the finance part.
Excuse me, but Representative Morgan has a question followed by Representative Swales, and then Representative Dietrich. I'm sorry, go ahead, Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Stevens, I appreciate the challenge of the shortage of teachers in the state, particularly in areas like science and math and ELL, special education. I know right now there are currently teachers in some of those very areas working at Burnsville High School, where I teach when I'm not here, very competent, qualified people who went through the process of getting their license, and they're doing very well. I guess my question to you, and I think I'll have a follow-up if I may, Madam Chair, what is it about the current process that is such a detriment to people entering the profession, when I know personally that there are those who do, and how does this alternate pathway make it easier without making it easier, if you know what I mean, without reducing the rigor of the process?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Morgan. It's another way of attracting people into the profession. We're certainly not talking about getting rid of the traditional pathway, but we're trying to think of strategies where we could attract some of our students who may have thought about going into math or science, someone who may be thinking about medicine but would be a really good candidate for special education. And to look at students who, as the UTeach example is, maybe they're going into and they're thinking about going into a math and science career, but we identify students that have, you know, are making good grades and are good students, and giving them a little taste of what it would be like to become a teacher by offering them some free credit or free courses to see if they would be interested in teaching. So that's one of the areas. The other area is looking at mid-career changes. About once a week, I get someone who is very interested in coming into the teaching profession who has been in the private sector for a while. I even get PhD. I get professors in colleges that call and say, I would really like to, you know, consider taking my skill and going into the K-12 system. What are the processes for doing that? And right now, the process is you have to go back and, you know, get two or more years of education. To me, if you already have a degree and you've been practicing and working in that field for quite a while, and you have excellent credentials and you are vetted as far as, you know, whether you would be a good candidate, why not then provide that professor who has a PhD or someone who has been working in a field for a number of years the opportunity to get the pedagogy that they need. Certainly, it's not enough to have content knowledge, but to know how to deliver it. So this would be another way of possibly attracting people into the teaching profession that would be interested in doing it. It's not to take away from the candidates now that are going through the traditional. But these folks, like the mid-career changers, have already gone through college. It's not like they don't have a degree. They've already been educated, and they've been practicing a profession. We would not expect them to just go into the classroom, but would have intensive, and what we're talking about is intensive, at least 200 hours of instruction behind that with a mentor, a one-on-one mentor, also vetted by a selection committee to see. And then after that year, if they have made, you know, satisfactory demonstration that they can, you know, be a good teacher, then give them their license. But they're just different strategies of trying to attract people, particularly in our shortage areas. But it is not to diminish those high school students that want to go in and become a teacher and go through the traditional process. They, of course, don't have the kind of, they don't have a bachelor's degree yet. They don't have the private sector experience that someone who has graduated fresh out of college potentially, or those who are in college, and we would, you know, try to entice them to go into it. And then they would stay in, of course, and finish up doing the traditional route or the mid-career changer. Representative Parkinson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that explanation. I appreciate the fact that you want to make sure that those programs, those alternate pathways, are rigorous and provide people with the opportunities to gain the skills really in the art of teaching. And that's very important because it's not just content knowledge. Obviously, content knowledge is very important, but there is an art to it, and that art is developed over time. And even the current process does not probably fully expose someone to all the tools they will need. They continue to develop those over time. But I appreciate that. I'm just concerned that, again, how different can we make it to reduce the barrier? How different can we make it to make it easier for people to pursue this pathway without making it easier to become a teacher? And that's what I'm struggling with, and I guess I look forward to seeing some more details and so forth about the exact structure of the program and how much time they would spend and who would the mentors be and how would the schools be compensated for the time that the mentors spending time with these people and how soon would they be thrown into the classroom and be responsible for students and responding to parents and those kinds of things. But those are just some of my concerns, and I guess I don't need a full answer to that now, but I look forward to chatting with you or others more about that.
Commissioner Speaker. Madam Chair, part of the appropriation would be to set up the mentor program so that that would be part of the compensation, so that we would have highly qualified mentors. We would work closely with a higher ed institution or institutions to help set up a program like this. So it would not be just something that would be cooked up, if you will, but would be something that we would develop with the expertise of a higher ed institution to do that. So we are just trying to think of ways that we can think about the 21st century and our X, Y, and Zers who are going to be out there wanting to, you know, who may not stay in education for a full 30 years or who may want to come back after they've been in the private sector. So we have some potential out there, and that's what we're trying to do.
Thank you, Commissioner Speaker. Members, I think we have to move on. Representative Ansels, did you have a comment to make? Sir?
I'll pass.
Thank you. Representative Swales. Representative Swales.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just would like to tell Commissioner Segrin that I'm really feeling like we're doing some things right here. And from our work over the past year and all of our bills and all of our discussions, one of the things that we have really been talking about is teacher development and teacher training. Representative McFarland and Garland and I had the opportunity to travel to Texas last year together, and we were at the University of Texas and actually went to a session in the nanotechnology building, and it was related to UTEC. And Texas is getting some things right, and I think by using that as a model, that is an excellent thing. I do have some questions about it, though, and that is, as you're thinking about this, I'm sure it's not set in stone yet on how you're going to have policies related to this. But have you figured out, like, when a person qualifies for a grant, what do you do with people who transfer or drop out? Are they required to teach in Minnesota? You know, those kinds of questions need to be answered. There needs to be a commitment, I believe, from the individual before they become involved in that program, that they will give at least 2 to 5 years of teaching experience to the state of Minnesota if they receive those funds in that program. The other thing, yesterday, Representative Dietrich and Brown and I had the opportunity to talk with Commissioner Sieglin, and one of the things that has been on the back burner of my thinking is that in the state of Arkansas, they have made AP training accessible to their teachers statewide, and they have opened up teacher institutes regionally so that more teachers can be trained in those classes that you know, when you are given the strategies of AP or pre-AP, you can start using those strategies as early as fourth and fifth grade, which is what they're doing in the state of Arkansas. I would really urge you, Commissioner Sieglin, to continue to put that kind of model in the forefront of discussions in the department. I think it would serve our teachers well to be continually given opportunities for those high-level thinking, critical thinking, problem-solving skills that they can transmit to their students. Even if they are teaching in a regular class of students or students who have definite academic challenges, I believe that a rising tide lifts all ships, and that level of training and rigor will do nothing but enhance our education for our state.
Madam Chair, I'm Representative Wells. I couldn't agree with you more. And one of the principles of our academies will be to work on those kind of high-level and critical thinking, problem-solving types of teaching strategies for students and for teachers to learn about them. And we also discussed, you know, how we could use our teacher math and science academies to do those kinds of AP trainings too. Right now, as you had mentioned, we only have 2 sites where teachers can go to be trained in AP. We talked about talking with the College Board about setting up some regional training sites because part of the Teacher Academy strategy is that we are to collaborate in the regions with a higher ed institution. So there's all sorts of potential with the academies that that can be grown as we do this. And of course, my dream would be that once we get the math and science academies up and running, that then we add subject areas over time so that we really have a robust regional professional development training opportunity for all teachers on an ongoing basis, and everyone is getting the kind of consistent, high-quality support and staff development that's accessible regionally to them.
And Commissioner Steven, maybe you will share with Representative Foyle's answers to her questions. I'm going to move on to Representative Dietrich.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Mary, I have a question for Mr. Klein.
Mr. Klein, please identify yourself and begin your answer once he asks the question.
Mr. Klein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In your testimony, you made the comment that occupations are no longer linear. Would you please tell me just a little bit about that, what you mean by that, and the real-life application of that?
Well,
real-life...
Okay, thank you. Well, what we're seeing, especially in the business that I'm in, is that you have skills and experiences that transcend or allow you to go between different types of roles and jobs. You may start as a math teacher. You may find yourself working, have the opportunity to work as a research person in the company. You may decide to go back into teaching at some point in time. So what you talk about is not so much the job, but employability and the skill set and experiences that open doors. And increasingly, because there's such a gap in pipeline, employers are much more open to looking at people that have skills and experiences that in the past they may not have necessarily associated with about decision making to bring people into roles. I know in the consulting business, we're clearly looking at people that can do analysis, financial analysis, make decisions. Their disciplines don't have to be in a single path. What has to be important is their ability to critically think, analyze, communicate, and collaborate.
That's very interesting.
Representative Beecher.
Thank you. Listened to some other futuristic type education speakers, and they talk about that skill set is more important than actually, some even go so far as to say degrees, not to minimize the degree. But then let me just ask you a question. This is probably out of your expertise, but I believe that the business community and the education community need to talk more. And in fact, I participated in the DEED stakeholders meetings around the state, and there was not one small group discussion that I heard that did not reiterate that. They all came to the conclusion that education and business community need to speak more, especially when we have such, in my opinion, honorable business community leaders like yourself who have a real sincere interest in raising the tide for all of the school children in the state of Minnesota. But anyhow, so my question is, do you think that schools have made adequate adaptation to take into account that the job markets, the jobs have changed from a maybe circular something besides linear? Or do you think that our schools continue to be linear? And is that conflicting?
I don't profess to be an expert. In fact, one of the things that we've done with the Minnesota High Tech Association is done a monthly field trip to school.
Wow.
And it's been very informative for me to actually go out in the front line and see how our teachers are teaching what they're doing. There are some schools that are now going cross-discipline where they're taking math and physics and English and tying those together into projects to deliver results. I would say that the students that are going those kinds of multidisciplinary kind of efforts seem to be more prepared to take on what most companies are looking for in the workforce. So I'm optimistic in what's out there. And I do believe that businesses can get more involved with educators at a local level. That's why the High Tech Association is so involved and active in this, because we believe that to get the workforce we want, we need to be practically involved working with the teachers to deliver that downstream.
I too am optimistic, and it's very refreshing to have people from the business community come and join us in our optimism. The unfortunate thing is that we have an over $900 million deficit that we have to deal with, and that deflates us a little, but you know, we need to continue to forge forward. One last comment on the website, the cooperative, where you can, you know, look for mentorships and all that type of stuff. Having been looking into high school redesign for the past 6 months, any state school district that is really serious about high school redesign focuses on relationships, and part of those relationships are internships more rather than less, and mentorships. And so to have that type of access to the business community, to have kids have that relationship through those positive experiences is great. But is that going to be adequate? Do you have enough business support interest for all the kids in the state, or is this going to become a little more fragmented?
Mr. Klein.
I believe the challenge you obviously have is in-state and out-state relative to businesses and where they're located. And so that is a challenge. Most companies have an association where their employees live and are raising their children. So that's a natural connection that we can leverage and must leverage. The question is, how do you then handle that in an off-state situation? And some companies are open to doing that because of the loyalty it brings to those students to stay in the state and work for them. So I think there's an opportunity for us to, as businesses, to get more involved in the out-state activities to garner the loyalty and understanding of those students so they'll select and work with our companies here locally versus the choices they might make otherwise.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And this is for Commissioner Seguin. I like your strategy number two. It reminds me of some of our recruiting methods in the military. Recruit the best, the brightest in the teaching profession. I like that. Representative Bent and I were talking here just shortly ago that one thing that we took advantage of when we were getting our degrees was that our student loan repayment program was deferred if we went into teaching, and we took advantage of that, and that I know that helped. 50% of our loans was deferred, and we paid back the other 50%, but that was an incentive for me, anyway, to get into education. I wanted to be a teacher anyway, but that they gave me some incentive. Is there any way we can bring back that type of program?
Mr. Speaker, Representative Detmer, we did propose something a little bit similar to that. In fact, I was the author of a loan forgiveness bill, it was a while ago, and it did not pass the legislature. But we were trying to, again, address the shortage areas, require somebody who had, you know, loan forgiveness to teach in the shortage areas and be expected to teach for, you know, a certain number of years. And if they didn't, then, you know, they had to pay their loan, you know, loan back proportionally to where the lack of commitment was, if you will. So we tried that, and it did not go anywhere. So,
Representative Detmer, do you have a follow-up?
No, I don't.
Representative Hiker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll be short again. Commissioner, you had mentioned we're getting into the 21st century, and again, I think that we come up with all these new ideas, which is fine, but I think we're overlooking the crux of the problem. We are 24th in the world in math. The latest Nation at Risk had a large report out, and again, what they have suggested is that we need to look at the time spent with the student in school. They suggested 7 hours. We have certain school districts larger than the state of Minnesota at 336 minutes, far, far below that. We keep throwing money at underperforming schools and not addressing the problem. The governor of New Mexico, Washington, D.C., among others, now have got programs where they require underperforming schools to go longer, not only in a day, but the year. I mean, we have to start, before we start to attack, you know, I think we've got the best faculty in the United States here in Minnesota. Talked about Representative Swales. I've been down to Texas. I've had some friends that applied there. They got hired on the spot because they knew the teachers were trained in Minnesota. We have got good faculty here. We've still got good numbers that we're doing very well in the academics and in reading and math, and that we test very high, even though we're throwing less money at it. But we need to look at how we are spending our time with the students. You can't get it. I mean, Benson just added 16 minutes to the day, and they added 6.5 days, but still doing it. We now have 2 days.
Have a question?
But to the point. My point being is that we need to look at the crux of the problem, and I don't think it is with finding new ways of doing math and science and everything else. I think we have to look at how we're using our time.
Commissioner. Madam Chair, I think it's all of those things. It's not one or the other. Certainly we need more time on tasks, but we also need to support our teachers. Our standards are changing dramatically in the math and science area, and our teachers need to be supported as they're learning new strategies. So we also need more time on tasks. We need to make sure that our teachers are continually being professionally developed. And we also know that, as I said at the beginning of my remarks, about 50% of our teachers are going to be leaving the profession, so the very folks that we know are doing an outstanding job are going to be leaving, and we need to replace them. And we know that the pipeline is not going to be filled by the traditional methods. We need to think of some other ways that we can guarantee quality but attract some of our best and brightest into the field in addition to the traditional route. So it's all of those things.
Representative Garofalo, very short.
Well, Madam Chair, I just wanted to comment regarding the discussion of technology that I'm a network engineer, so I do this for a living. And I respect the fact that the system wants to have teachers trained the way they have in the past because it works then, and they want to do it in the future. And I respect the fact that people want to educate kids the way they have in the past and do it in the future. But it doesn't apply to technology. We don't need to do it that way. For example, in my career, what I do, no one knows the stuff I do. There's a total shortage of network engineers in this state. And what it's doing is it's stifling the economy and stifling economic growth. There are private sector companies out there that would pay, put their stuff in the schools just so kids can train on it and learn it. And these kids can leave high school and get high-paying jobs right out of high school. They don't need to go for 4 years. And I want people to keep an open mind about in the area of technology what effect this has, because these private sector, again, the people who produce these goods, they want people to understand their product because they can't sell it right now because one of the sellability problems is no one knows how to configure this stuff. So
thank
that's
you,
my little spiel.
Representative Garland, do you have any announcements for us for future meetings? Since we did not get to the other part of your agenda, and I apologize.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. No, we started a little bit late because we were waiting for Representative Garofalo. We knew that he was the one that wanted to know about shifts, and we waited and waited, and so we're off schedule all because of him. So, seriously, the commissioners indicated that she's more than willing to come back, and perhaps Representative Mariani will be more healthy at that time, and he can help with being sitting here like I am. I've been such a help today with this bill. So, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Garland. Meeting adjourned.